Welcome to the UN and Organised Crime, a podcast from the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organised Crime. I'm Ian Tennant. This episode reflects on what was supposed to be the concluding session of the UN's ad hoc committee that had been set up to negotiate a new convention on cybercrime, or to use its correct name, the criminal misuse of information and communications technology. Following seven negotiating sessions over 2 years, each lasting 2 weeks and costing almost $1 million each for the UN, member states have still not come to agreement on what the convention should do, or indeed, what its name should be. The polarization between different camps in the negotiations has been apparent throughout, but even in the last few days of the session, it was expected that some kind of compromise would be reached and a treaty would be adopted. In this episode, I'll be speaking to my two colleagues from the Global Initiative who followed the proceedings at the UN building in New York over those 2 weeks at the end of January and beginning of February to get their insights on what happened, why a convention hasn't been adopted, and what happens next. So, welcome to Summer Walker and Ana Paula Oliveira, who together with me have been following this process and engaging with it over the last couple of years. My first question is to Ana. Ana, these were high-stakes negotiations, but also legally complex, with a lot of participants from different countries, a lot of observers from different sectors. How did the committee organize itself to try to reach consensus? And how was the atmosphere in the room?
Thanks, Ian. Thanks for having me on the podcast. The tension in the room was tangible, I think. DHC, as you mentioned, was mandated to finish in these 2 weeks in New York with a draft treaty to be presented at the General Assembly. There was this pressure of time to find a document in the end and to possibly avoid a vote. And for the chair and many member states, there was this hope that in the end of that session, we would have that document. And considering that in the sixth session, so the previous one before the concluding session, only a few provisions were adopted at referendum, which means that member states would generally agree with the provisions, subject to final details. It felt that in the beginning of this concluding session, DHC was already running a bit out of time. So to try to address this, the methodology of the chair was precisely designed to expedite the discussions. And the decision was then to divide the session in two tracks. In the plenary, member states would be engaging in an open discussion. But in practice, what happened was that the session in the plenary focused on the least contentious points. And the feeling for those who were attending to the meeting was that potentially the committee was progressing because there was a full speed in terms of moving into chapter to chapter and provision to provision. However, in parallel to the plenary, there was this open and informal discussions where member states were diving into the most contentious issues that polarized the full extent of the DHC, as you mentioned. And as a result as well, I think this track was divided in various sub-tracks. So for us, civil society attending to the meeting, there was this feeling of difficulty of trying to follow up on what was really happening and whether we were going to have a treaty, a binding legal instrument at the end. And there was kind of a novelty for civil society there as well, because this process was constantly open and transparent. So this two-side approach was very novel for us, I think. And as days were passing by, I think up to the middle of the second week, it was still this idea that potentially we would have a treaty. But after that, I think it became clear and clear that this goal was very difficult to be achieved, in particular if the goal was to have a document that was consensual. And the reality of the politics around the room was just that we didn't have enough time to really see that document coming through. And the decision of the committee ultimately was to suspend the session and reconvene later this year.
You said that the tension was tangible and it seemed like a treaty was seeming like it was going to be possible right up into the middle of the second week. And as things changed and as it became clearer that the committee was going to make that decision to extend, did you feel some of that tension dissipate?
Oh, I think so. I think when we arrived in the room on Friday, there was this feeling that, yes, we're not going to have a treaty. So things can be a little bit more relaxed in the sense of waiting for the big discussions, the big issues to be discussed in the future opportunity. I don't think that those issues did have the time to mature enough. But I think also there was a progress made, because many of the provisions that were less contentious, some progress were made in that regard. So I think the kind of maybe the feeling of some sort of relax, if I could say this, came from that as well. But I don't know, this was just my perspective.
Thank you. I'm going to go over to Summer Walker now. Summer, you've been following this process for a long time. You know, Anna laid out kind of what the process was like, what the decisions were like. You know, the fact that on some of those big issues, the states hadn't made progress on coming together yet. So can you outline what you see as being the key issues that prevented consensus from being achieved in New York? And have you seen progress from when the committee started to where it is now on those big issues?
Yeah, I mean, I think really the problem with the concluding session is that the main sticking points from the beginning were all still there and they hadn't been resolved. So while the governments were sitting in the plenary, sort of still debating line by line how to write this final treaty, they hadn't resolved overarching issues that were critical to deciding what this treaty actually is. And that actually goes down straight to the name, right? So should it be a cybercrime convention, or should it be a convention of crimes committed using ICT? The second being much wider and much more expansive. Arguably, the drafts that had been shared would have included cyber-dependent crimes, but there would have been no prioritization of them. Whereas with a cybercrime convention, the feeling was that it should be narrower and it should really focus on the major cyber dependent crimes that are really crippling some governments and their ability to respond. And a lot of the other issues that I would bring up in connection to this are all along the same lines. They're about the scope, the breadth of the treaty, the allowances it would give to governments in order to sort of control the internet or control online spaces. Really at the heart of this, that's sort of where we left at the concluding session, which is now not the final session.
Yes. In some ways, the process is looking at the same issues now than it was at the beginning, is what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. They haven't resolved the key tensions that were always present.
So Anna, you were there at the end of the session. I mean, now that this session has concluded, they haven't moved together on those key issues that Summer outlined. I mean, what was the reaction from delegates and multi-stakeholders that you spoke to? I mean, I'm sure there's a spectrum from disappointments on one side from those who most wanted a convention to relief on the others who were pointing out the risks. How would you characterize the reaction that you saw?
I guess the same way you just did. I think from the beginning of the process, the ultimate goal was to have a draft. So for those who were really working towards that goal, some frustration might have occurred. And obviously, there was also the spectrum of countries who really wished to have a treaty to prosecute cybercrime, and that also going back to the domestic capitals, and that might bring some sort of frustration in that sense as well. The process was not as long as in comparison to other treaties, in particular the UNCTAD, if we compare it to this one, but it was very intense in terms of a very comprehensive timeline and a very strict timeline, but also the geopolitics around it. So I think there's also a sense of tiredness and fatigue towards not having a closure. And we have some uncertainty as well of what's going to happen next. So when the session would be resumed, what would be the mood? Have we lost the momentum? I think the same with civil society would apply to those civil societies who are really pushing forward treaty that would respect human rights and would be useful instrument to tackle cybercrime while preventing some misuse and abuse of that treaty. That feeling of relief that you mentioned could have occurred as well. Summer just mentioned the most contentious issues, and those are the issues that will have the more severe implications to civil society. So having the reassurance that states will have more time to think about how this treaty would play out for sure had some implications in this feeling of relief of not having to rush into that document to comply with the timeline that was initially foreseen.
Yeah, I think the sense of fatigue is very important. And I know that this was covered by some delegates in the closing, expressing concerns about whether they would even have the resources to be able to continue covering this. So Summer, going back to you again, from your perspective as an expert on how things work at the UN in New York, the committee itself has basically decided to extend itself, but it still has a deadline of the current General Assembly session. You know, so in practice, what has to happen for that session to be convened within its timeline, within its mandate? What do you expect to happen?
Yeah, thanks again. I think actually one point about New York, which we haven't quite touched on, which is interesting, is that this process kicked off with a set of rules that were drafted in New York and rather contentiously. So they were issues were taken to a vote instead of just consensus-based rules on how the process should run. And there was the opportunity to take decisions to a vote in this last session. And none of that happened. So really, I think you saw people willing to extend and still try to reach consensus as opposed to sort of taking it to the mat and figuring out how to finalize this thing really quickly by strong-arming certain positions through. At the same time, the opportunity for the vote was a strong safeguard in itself against text that wouldn't have really flown for many of the regions and many of the different voting groups, which we know exist. So basically, now we have an extension that they have requested, and what they're going to need to do is come up with the funding. They need to reserve the space, the rooms. Actually, July in New York is quite busy because it's the annual convening of the SDGs, Sustainable Development Goals. So there's a lot of actually bureaucratic issues that could hold this process up. So let's see how this goes, but it's not easy to bring together all the countries. And really, I mean, the amount of countries that have attended this have been really exceptional. So to bring everybody back together to get this thing done, you also will need some meetings in between, right? Because they're not going to come to New York to finish it and achieve consensus along these issues that they still really can't find common ground on. So you'd have to have some money and some time and organization for informals, which would probably take place in Vienna, and possibly intersessionals with groups like civil society and private sector to address certain issues. So there's really a lot of mechanics that still need to be put into place in order to get back to the actual substantive content.
Yeah, I think you've outlined that there's still uncertainty, but also that there has been a high degree of interest from the member states in this process. Whether they agree on the substance or not is another question, but you know, in terms of attendance, in terms of engagement, the levels have been very high, as you say, including actually with civil society, private sector, and others. Just to finish, before we come back in another episode to maybe talk about the next session, which could take place in the summer this year. Do you, Anna, and Summer, question to both of you, have any views on what the international community can do in the meantime, whilst this process continues to work itself out, as the problem of cybercrime and indeed wider cyber-related crimes are getting worse, causing problems? What else can we do as the interested constituency on these issues? Maybe I'll ask Anna first.
Sure. I think for us, civil society, I think it's important to continue to monitor the phenomenon, of course, continue to input this research back to the process, highlighting the trends around cybercrime, as well as the implications that this treaty might have once it's approved, adopted, and implemented. I think it's also a time to take advantage of the time that we have now to think about the process and see when it goes forward the way that it should be doing. And I think also, as part of civil society interested in the process, the best way that we can contribute to how it develops. So I think it's an important time to strategize, I would say, and thinking ahead of when the session resumes, to how can we collaborate with the sticking points that still are out there.
Yeah. So it's not a time to relax. It's a time to think more strategically to make sure we get our inputs right for the last session. Summer, what are your thoughts?
I mean, I know this is not a popular view among many regional blocs, but you know, there is the Budapest Convention, and there have been more people signing up to it since the beginning of the AHC process than previously. So, you know, there is architecture and infrastructure that exists that is not just the Council of Europe countries, but there's about 66 members, probably more at this point. So, you know, cooperation is happening, and building on those areas where it's successful is a good opportunity, I would say. You know, a lot of the language from the Budapest Convention was taken and dropped into this UN treaty draft as well. And, you know, there are existing platforms where cooperation is already happening. So besides the Budapest Convention, you know, you have the OAS project on cybercrime. So there are places where you can actually already cooperate as opposed to waiting for this treaty in order to get started.
Well, on that note, thank you very much, Summer. Thank you very much, Anna. It's been a pleasure talking to you. We will no doubt be coming back to this process again. And Anna, you've laid out what we should be doing as civil society in the meantime as we prepare for the next iteration of this process. And Summer, you've outlined, you know, that there are other things outside of this process that can be done to respond to the problems of cybercrime and to enhance international cooperation on these issues, which I think the one thing everybody can agree on is that the problem is there and that more cooperation is needed. So hopefully all of us can find ways of doing that, whether we're in private sector, civil society, or within the member states. You've been listening to the UN and Organized Crime, a podcast from the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime.